Zehntens, Schulbildung. Damals war die Polizei schwach, die Familie war stark. Gerions Mutter führte ihn am ersten Schultag an der Hand zur Schule. Sie richtete ihm die kleinen roten Flügel und schob ihn durch die Tür hinein. Elftens, Recht. Gibt es viele kleine Jungen, die glauben, sie sind ein Monster? Nur dass ich, was mich angeht, Recht habe, sagte Gerion zu seinem Hund. Sie saßen auf den Klippen, der Hund sah zu ihm auf, voll Freude. Das war ein Auszug aus so einer Art Vorspann zu einem Buch, das ich erst letztes Jahr entdeckt habe, obwohl es, glaube ich, vor 10, 12, 13 Jahren schon publiziert wurde. Und zwar von der kanadischen Autorin Anne Carson. Es heißt Autobiography of Red, die Autobiografie von Rot. Und weil ich festgestellt habe, dass ich in ein, zwei Minuten so viel Schlaues gar nicht sagen kann oder will von mir selber aus, habe ich gedacht, ich würde euch extrem gerne dieses Buch ans Herz legen, weil das kann so zwei Dinge. Das ist literarisch irgendwie super nerdy und interessant und bezaubernd für sich selber. Und abgesehen davon ist es aber auch, also kann es was, was mir schon sehr, sehr lange nicht mehr passiert ist, nämlich dieser Gerion, der im Übrigen eine Figur ist, die sich Anne Carson aus der griechischen Mythenwelt rausleiht quasi und so ins 20. Jahrhundert nach Amerika versetzt, der wird zu einem Freund. Also wie so zu Kindergartenzeiten man einen neuen Freund findet. Und ich finde, es hat, also es hat mich so erinnert an das Tollste, was passieren kann, wenn man ein Buch liest, was ja erstmal sehr trocken ist, dass man auf einmal so einen kleinen Kumpel findet, der einen irgendwie begleitet und so neben einem herläuft. Und dann ist es auch noch einer, der, woran man nur stellenweise erinnert wird, eben auch noch rote Flügel hat und eigentlich ein Monster ist, aber in allererster Linie ein super komplexer, trauriger, schöner, fröhlicher, freundlicher Kerl, der ein Freund ist. Ich lese noch eine ganz kurze Stelle. Gerion stand erstarrt mitten auf einem Gehsteig in Buenos Aires. Menschen fluteten zu beiden Seiten seines Mantels an ihm vorbei. Menschen, dachte Gerion, für die das Leben ein berückendes Abenteuer war. Er entfernte sich in die Tragikomödie der Menge. Und ich bin Maren Kames und ihr hört den Spexo-Podcast. Viel Spaß.
Willkommen zur sechsten Ausgabe unseres Spex-Podcasts. Für diese Ausgabe haben wir zwei Gästinnen in unser Podcast-Studio eingeladen. Ojo Higbe, Oman Blanks Omohimi. Kurz Oman Blanks, der ist in Benin geboren und in Lagos und Nigeria aufgewachsen. Mittlerweile lebt er in Ghana und hat dort das multimediale Projekt The Art Concept gegründet. Dazu gesellt sich Nadia Ofuate-Alazar, die in Berlin lebt. Sie ist Journalistin und Filmemacherin, hat im letzten Jahr das Buch »Wie Rassismus aus Wörtern spricht« im Unrast Verlag mit herausgegeben. Und außerdem ist sie Geschäftsführerin des Berliner Vereins EOTO, kurz für Each One Teach One. Dieser Verein, der setzt sich für die Interessen schwarzer, afrikanischer und afrodiasporischer Menschen in Deutschland und Europa ein. Die Projekte von Nadia und Oman Blanks, die haben daher viel gemein. Beide verstehen sich als Plattform, um schwarzes Wissen zu sammeln, zu archivieren, zu erforschen und weiterzutragen. Zum einen eben aus afrikanischer, aus kontinentaler, zum anderen aus afrodiasporischer Sicht. Wir wollten mit ihnen sprechen über heterogene schwarze Perspektiven und Erzählungen, Dekolonialisierung und Empowerment. Wie passend, dass im Februar Black History Month ist. Was es damit auf sich hat, dazu jetzt gleich mehr in unserem Gespräch. Mit dabei meine Spex-Kolleginnen Julian Dörr und Neni Sowe. Viel Spaß dabei. Wir hören uns danach wieder und nicht nur mich, sondern auch Klaus Walter mit einer neuen Ausgabe seiner Kolumne Gegenwartsfunde.
A very warm welcome to all of you guys. I'm really happy that you're here. Nadia, you're an author, artist, filmmaker, managing director of EOTO, based in Berlin.
Hi.
Oman Blanks, you're the founder and creative director of The Art Concept in Ghana, in Accra.
Hi.
Julian Dörr, also my colleague here from Spex, and Nina Sobe, also colleague from Spex.
Hi.
I'm so glad that you're all here. This talk today for the Spex podcast actually is in connection with Black History Month, which is in February. Over 100 years ago, in 1915, Black historian Carter G. Woodson, who was actually the second African-American student to get a PhD degree from Harvard University, founded the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History in Chicago. He also initiated a Black History Week, which then eventually became Black History Month in the US and in Canada, and it has been adapted in a lot of places all around the world who organize cultural events and so on. Nadia, you from EOTO, which is a community-based education and empowerment project and association in Berlin, I've seen that you also organized events celebrating Black History Month. Why do you think it's important to adapt this concept in Germany?
Well, actually, to be honest, you know, for many years I've been quite ambivalent about the concept of Black History Month because I find that Black history and Black presence and Black cultural production is an everyday thing and should be integrated in the whole narrative. But yeah, so, but nevertheless, I do, and we do celebrate and organize events. As it's also because we do so many projects in the course of the year, and so it's also nice to put the focus on this community event and provide a space for the various Black communities in Berlin, and also sort of present all our projects, all the works we do, you know, in this framework.
Mm-hmm. And Oman Blanks, you are taking part in an event regarding Black History Month in Hamburg. It's a panel discussion on empowerment that you will document and display in the audiovisual online archive, The Art Concept, that you initiated. Why did you come to Germany to archive that discussion, and what is it going to be about?
So my work is just me paying attention to what documentation is, what archiving is. And from an African first perspective, then a Black perspective, I've been documenting contemporary conversations. So a lot of people, once they hear archiving, they'd be like, oh, it must be historical and you must go back. Yes, but it's also very important to begin to think about how we document and archive for the next generation, which might be 2 hours or 300 years from now, right? How are we documenting our conversations? How are we expanding the narratives? Because there's so many stereotypes and a lot of people focus on those stereotypes. And I feel like the more we expand the narratives, the more we reduce the stereotypes, right? And yeah, it's all about inclusion. So we've been documenting in Ghana, Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, South Africa. And I was like, yeah, it's time to start documenting conversations around the Black and African community outside of the continent also to start keep adding to the conversation. So that's why I'm here.
Can you give us a more specific description of like how these conversations look like? Is it just you and one person and a camera team that we are really interested in? Yeah, what these conversations actually are like, or are they all different?
Yeah, so the conversation takes so many forms, you know. It's like, because once you say Black and African, there's no field, like there's no one direction you can go. So the topics might determine the type of production. Like for instance, the last conversation we documented in Accra was the conversation on how to manage the loss of a parent, right? Because that's also one conversation that is been said for a long time. Oh, Black people do not talk about grief and the process of mourning and all of that. And it was 10 of us in conversation speaking about each other's loss. I've lost a mom. Last year, it was 18 years. And the next person beside me, she had just lost a mom 2 years ago. And we had someone who had lost a mom for 32 years. And the funny thing about it is that we all shared the same feelings, the same ideas. We all felt like those who had never gone through any kind of loss really do not know how to communicate with people who are going through loss. You can't tell people how to mourn. You can't tell them how long they should. And as Black and Africans, and we were just having that conversation, you know? And so when you have a conversation like that, you want the camera to document everybody speaking. So that was like a three camera crew kind of setting. But then there are conversations that are like one-on-one, just two people in conversation. It could be a friend, it could be strangers. So it's like it takes from one to like 10 people. Then we have conversation where there's a panel, there's an audience. After the panel, I've gone through one of our panel conversations was Fela a feminist, right? That was a very interesting one. And Q&A, so we document everything. And we just started a format called 1 minute, 50 seconds, where Black people and Africans just speak or display whatever they feel like for a minute and 50 seconds, and that's it.
The project is called The Art Concept, and can you tell us a little bit more about it? Can you give us an idea of what it is, when it was founded, and what was the initial start to do this?
So I'm a very curious person, and observing people is a very big hobby of mine. So I'm that person who might go to a party. Though I organize events, I produce festivals, that's another thing I do as a creative director. But when I'm not doing that, I am the person who would go for an event, find a corner, sit, and just watch people, right? That's something that I do. So coming from that view, 2012 precisely, Nigeria was going through a very funny moment. So they just removed the subsidy from oil in Nigeria that year, and everybody went crazy because the fuel price went up, the trade unions went on strike, they shut the country down, and you know how the news gets so populated by professionals, government opinions, and all of that. A group of us decided to go into the street to document what the people felt, were feeling, what they wanted to say. And as we were documenting, I was realizing like there's a very big gap between the people who say they speak for the masses and what the masses are actually saying. And that was what just struck the fire. And from then on, I personally made a documentary, sat down with Femi Kuti, and we're just talking about society and how leaders in society have completely, and leaders, I don't just mean political leaders, like whoever feel like they're leaders in society or present themselves as such. A lot of them are very distant from the society they actually lead, right? And from that onset, I just started documenting. Audio conversations, having conversations in my home, inviting people, strangers, friends, and just been thinking about what to do. Historically, we all, when we talk about African identity and we talk about the illegal invasion and illegal colonization and all of those things that happened, one of the things you find is the destruction of our system, the like very tactical destruction of our arts, our politics, our religion and everything. But one thing they could not really destroy is the oral storytelling, because you can't really do anything to that, right? And that's where my real inspiration comes from. How do we document and make sure that knowledge, who controls the knowledge production, we control it, but then it's documented in a way that it can be destroyed and it's very accessible. And I feel like audiovisual makes it way more accessible beyond text, right? I'm not saying text is not fantastic, but it reduces access. And I just feel like knowledge producers should start taking advantage of videos and audio because it opens the access to every other person.
I actually think that Iyoto Nadia, it's each one teach one, that saying has a lot to do with oral history as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Oral history is a vital part, and the idea that everybody is a producer of knowledge and that it's valid and that in order to get a full image of something, you need this polyphony. And you have to be very wary of structures of power, you know, who has access to what outlets, etc. And so, yes, even before I joined Iyoto, I tried to constantly create, you know, and not only in text, that is one aspect, but it's a high threshold often, you know, to work with text. And so I think filmmaking and recording audio is really, really vital. And when I, in 2016, I traveled the former German colonies on the African continent and produced four films together with a colleague, Nicolas Grange, who is a co-founder of Africa is the Future, if you know him. And these films were the first step, like, for me, coming from a German experience and perspective, but open up the space, also shut myself down a little bit and open up the space for an African discourse on German colonialism. Because even though colonialism has started to be present in the mainstream in Europe and in Germany, but it was completely lacking African perspectives. So that Remix Africa in Translation series is available on the website of Bundeszentrale für politische Bildung. It can be downloaded and used, disseminated. Each film is 45 minutes long. And so, yeah, I feel very, you know, like kindred to what you're saying. And Iyoto is very much about that. Absolutely. Yeah.
The art platform, the art concept, sorry, all my blanks, is actually mainly a website where you are archiving all the things that you are collecting, audiovisual stuff, the things you are filming and recording. Am I right?
It's not mainly a website. So first of all, it started from an idea. So it's a living idea. And the website is just one of the forms of physical manifestation, right? And the goal is to set up physical centers where people can actually walk in, sit down and research through thousands of conversations, whether it be perspective of women living in space, living in the art and science, whether it be it how to be a father, whether it be it religion and spirituality. So this is the goal. So now it's either I get truncated by the idea of, oh, how can I build this space? No fund, or I start. And that's what the website is. The website is us kickstarting where the direction is going. And also, eventually, the goal is not just to make available the edited ideas, because these documentaries are edited, right? But if you release an hour of conversation, you have like 3 or 5 hours of conversation. And our end goal is to make sure that people who really need those information can eventually see a series of film they like and say, can I get the raw file? You know, that's the end goal. That's how you keep pushing the boundary of accessibility and just clarity. And because it's not about me. And that's why I just love what you said. I have to learn the art of removing myself, right? So that my ideas do not cloud what the platform is supposed to do. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So actually in making, being present locally, building up places also like community centers, this is also something very close to Eyoto, right? Could you explain a bit more, Nadia, what Eyoto is as a place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've only been a part of Eyoto since the fall of 2017, but it was founded as a grassroots association. It was a voluntary engagement of people, and it all started in 2012 around a donation of books. So it was the testament of Vera Haya, an Afro-German activist and avid reader who had been collecting books for many, many years by African authors, by African diasporic authors. And so she had a collection of about, I think, 1,500 titles. And through Tina Bach, one of the founders of Eyoto, it did land in Wedding, in the neighborhood of Wedding in Berlin, and so they managed to get small rooms, you know, and some funding to pay the rent, which was low, and then really from that, around the books, around that library, and we call it the Vera Haya Archive, to honor her, it developed, it blossomed, and so at this point, we now have about a dozen employees, not all of them full time, but and then still many volunteers, obviously still, and so we are doing sort of the, well, we are professionalizing, you know, the structures, and on the same at the same time, we really want to keep the community alive and also the volunteering spirit alive, and that's sometimes a challenge. At this stage, what do we do? We still have the library. By now, we have around 8,000 titles. We have a large space now where also all the employees are located and they are working. We do youth work. That's really an important aspect. We do consulting for victims of anti-Black racism. We do a lot of political networking and lobbying, and we work internationally. So it's all about creating networks, and I'm also, I have the honor to be the director of the Afrolution Literature Festival that is hosted by Eyoto. Again, the idea of networking there is really important. So each year I choose a partner from the continent. Last year it was the Lagos Book Festival. Lola Shoneyin joined us with a delegation of artists from her last edition. And the upcoming one in June of 2020 will be in collaboration with Fervin Sars, Atelier de la Pensée, that's a Senegalese, more than a think tank, actually, and you know Ferwin Sar, so he's also coming with a delegation of about 10 artists from his last edition. So the idea of networking and creating strong bonds between Africa and its diasporas, but also engaging the global diasporas in the same space. So we always make sure we have people from Canada, the Caribbean, the US, etc., and to provide that space of discourse and exchange.
Yeah, I guess the main language is English then, and I was wondering, because the project should be accessible for all, but not everyone is able to speak English, mostly older people maybe in Africa, not everyone, but some people. So how do you think can you make it accessible for them, or how can you document their stories?
Okay, this is an important question, and it's something that I have been thinking a lot about and having conversations around. And the first question is no, not all the conversations are in English.
Okay.
Yes, because the continent, 54 countries, there's so many languages all over the place. We have conversations in French, we have in English. I have conversation with my grandmother, and I've documented my grandmother, and she speaks Asa. And so one of the things that I just stumbled upon is to translate. It's very hard to translate from maybe a local dialect like Asan to English. Sometimes they're not right words to actually do like a proper translation. So there are some parts of this documentation that we might just leave without translating them, because it's a form of preserving the language in its original self, right? And with the French and the English, eventually, I think as we begin to enter into new spaces, we begin to think about that a lot. For instance, if we tap into the Black community in Japan and that's what they speak, we begin to think about, okay, how can we make this more accessible to them? Or how can we make this more accessible to the community in Germany? Yes, it's something to think about, but you know that like the work about translating is it's a long work. And I'm just beginning this journey, and a lot of people who have come before me, it's still the conversation, like, there's so many languages, and English is a powering one, and I just feel like we must not always translate everything to English.
I was thinking about the importance of language as the medium of passing on and conserving knowledge, but also then with English and Africa and German, these are both colonial languages, and they have like the colonialism, and they have racist structures and these perspectives inscribed in them. But they're also the languages that you both work with. And Nadia, like you talked about the dictionary before, and Nadia, you wrote a book about racism and the German language and colonial structures in the German language. How do you deal with that problem that you are, you need to operate in these languages, but they are also the languages of the oppressing forces and the colonial, like they are colonial languages?
You go first.
Yeah. Okay. I do both. I do, you know, both things. But actually, I did not write the book. I'm one of the editors, together with Susan Arndt. And then we had a lot of authors coming from all walks of life. And that was really also the politics of that book. I love language. And so there are various thoughts I have about that. You're right. Certain concepts are inscribed. But language is a vital thing. It's a living thing. And I will take it. You know, mm-hmm. I will own it. I will appropriate it. Plus, German is my language. And so I take the right also to rework it, mm-hmm. to criticize it, to question it. I mean, it's such a fascist idea that there's a set way of doing this language and that it always has to remain. Yeah,
that
it's
language
like,
doesn't change.
I mean, it's like the weirdest idea ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, language is such a living, wonderful thing, and we need new words and we need new slangs and we need all the dialects that you find in that. So I cherish language and I own it, and I don't own it alone, you know. And I fight. It's a place of struggle, and translation is a creative act. It's hard. It's wonderful, you know, and there is always like a bit of also interpretation in the act of translation. But I'm also a big fan of translation, and now I'm in awe about the digital options that are now growing around that. And in terms of African languages, I mean, yes, these are colonial languages: English, French, German, Portuguese. I still. There is this act of appropriation also in the African diasporas. That is a good thing. That's a wonderful thing. Think of all the Creole languages, for example. But then also, I have a deep respect for African languages and a great desire to also support the acts of producing literature and text in them, and, you know, recording and then trying to translate, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't matter. But I'm also thinking that from my travels on the African continent, what became really clear is that the European culture institutes that are present there and that teach their languages and their cultures, like namely Goethe Institut, Institut Français, maybe to an extent British Council, they really dominate certain fields of cultural discourse. You know, they offer spaces, but they also basically own that space, and people have to, you know, hold their conversations there. And so I think what's really, 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 really necessary is to establish African cultural centers, not only on the continent, because, I mean, somebody in South Africa should be able to learn Swahili, and, you know, somebody in Morocco should learn Ewe. But also to keep these languages alive, to honor them, but also enable us in Europe, for example, to learn these languages, you know, and to really have that exchange. And for that, I find it's really necessary to start thinking about an international network, including on the African continent, for African cultural centers.
The way we look at, because at the end of the day, even the language, English, now our own now, you understand? We tonight speak now in a pidgin. We get pidgin for Nigeria, we get pidgin for Ghana, we get pidgin all over West Africa, and we get other countries for the continent, their pidgin, you understand? So obviously we get our own local language, but the English also now a language. Just like she just talked now. The German now a language. You know if you come out down, you understand? So at the end of the day, it be metamorphosis, you see. So we the add, we the remove. And this English now the one where I master the most. But I speak English. But this pidgin English where I speak now, when if I want to express myself to the very depth of them, now this one I speak. You get. And this now a combination of local references, local languages, and English. We look the English say, this English, I know if you use them to express myself like this, okay, make a flip them. So this is how it happens, you know. It's an integration. But also, it's important to pay attention to where is this coming from. And that's why it goes back to my premise for everything I do with TAC is, who are we? Where are we coming from? Then that informs where we are and where we're going to. And I just wanted to touch on the point about the institutions in the language and cultural institutions in the African continent, as Goethe Alliance, like you've mentioned. And right now, one of the conversations I'm having with colleagues, at least mainly between Lagos and Nigeria, and it's a conversation I want to bring here and take it as far as we can go. When you look at the pyramid, the structural leadership pyramid, they've been now in the continent since the 50s, 60s, and most of them keep sending white directors, right? And that in itself is a setback, because you have black people who are Germans and who speak German. And if they come into space, it's a faster way to integrate, right? And also it's a way to show that you understand and respect the community that you find yourself in, right? So it goes back to power, right? Because if you keep sending a white man and a white woman for forever, then what are you saying? So this is the reason why some of us have worked with institutions like this, and we'll continue to work with them, but we also continue to call them out, and we'll also continue to set up our own institutions, right? As we accept and denounce what we think is right or wrong. And every black person, and this is just the opinion from the point I document, every black person, every African person, however they want to enter the conversation about race, they are completely free to.
Well, speaking about colonial structures that are still all around us, Nadia, actually the place in Wedding where Ayutu is based, there was an ongoing discussion about street names in Wedding. And I saw that Ayutu is also involved in a new project together with Verein Berlin Postkolonial, which is about, it's going to be about Berlin's colonial history and about decolonization. Can you tell me a bit more about that new project and what actions are going to be taken, and maybe also how politics, German politics, how the support is, what it's like here?
Well, actually, yeah, it's a five-year project, and it's a liaison, it's a collaboration between the City Museum of Berlin and three NGOs, amongst them Berlin Postkolonial, Each One Teach One, IOTO, and also the Initiative of Black People in Germany, ISD. The funding is coming actually from the Berlin Senate for Culture and Europe, plus federal money from Kulturstiftung des Bundes. I don't know how to translate that. And so, yes, actually, because in the Berlin Coalition Treaty, the plan to acknowledge colonial history in Berlin, you know, is integrated. So, you know, there is a great interest by the current government or to address that, you know, and then also to decolonize, whatever that might mean. I think the project might give us an opportunity also to critically think about this very fashionable term, you know, by now. I personally still don't know what it means, because you cannot really undo colonialism. How can you do that? I would much prefer to take a good long moment to look at colonialism and its perseverance, and to be honest, but you know, I'm going to make that point very strong. But yeah, but there are also some really material things. Berlin Postkolonial and has been fighting for many years to change certain street names, because in Germany we still have street names that are named after colonial murderers and criminals, and so that is well on its way with some of the worst people, you know, historically, like Peters, Lüderitz, Nachtigall, you know, those street names will be changed. The project is quite complex. So it has three parts in a way, actually four. Let's start with the three. First of all, it's a map. It's a online mapping, that not only shows colonial spaces in Berlin, but also decolonial and critical spaces in Berlin and events. But most importantly, it's going to be a huge research project between historians here, critical historians, and in the Global South, particularly in Africa, and to map the relationship between Berlin, certain places in Berlin, and their counterpart, for example, in Windhoek, in Namibia. Then on the map, you see certain processes, historical processes, for example, or biography, people that traveled by force or by choice from the continent to Berlin, their stations, you know, or objects, you know. So it's going to tell like a lot of stories, but it's about showing the relationship and making it visible in the space of Berlin. And then ultimately, the map is going to expand to all of Germany. Other initiatives can also, you know, put their information there to be programmed, but also the initiatives and the partners on the continent. So it's going to be really interactive, and it's going to be growing. That's one thing. Then ISD, Initiative Schwarze Menschen in Deutschland, they will actually curate exhibits, but they will also, that are like sort of political education and cultural education about colonial history, but they will also challenge the Berlin museums. So they will penetrate their collections, they will challenge them, they will invite them to engage, point out certain problematic parts of their collections, and etc. So that is their thing. IOTO, we will do a festival and think tank series So similar to Afrolution, but in that case more integrated. So there are white people and there are other people of color. You know, Afrolution is an all-black festival event, but the Decoloniale Festival will be also about discourse, about art, about critical interventions, etc. So that's going to happen once a year. And then we have an ongoing think tank talking about and inviting specialists, especially from Africa, and, you know, from the local communities to engage on questions of remembrance and how is it appropriate to remember this history and have it be like a living thing, not just a monument and then it's done with, but how can it be like a living thing, you know, like a archive and a documentation center with a performance space, for example, but also some spaces to acknowledge the spiritual aspect, because that is really something that we must not forget. I mean, the spiritual universes that have been destroyed or really severely marred and compromised, that is something that needs to be reinvigorated and supported and acknowledged, because the mission came before the penetration in terms of, you know, soldiers and land grabbing. There was the colonization of the mind and of the spiritual space. And that kills a people, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. Or it really severely hampers them. And that is an ongoing thing. So, yeah, I'm looking, you know, but that will be like a polylogue on how to remember, how to be with that, what is already. Make it visible and then, yeah.
To add to that, so whenever I hear the idea of decolonization, it's always a very interesting one, because it's never ending, and you can't completely be decolonized if the knowledge base, if your curriculum, if whatever programming as a society that you fall under is white controlled. And if you look at it, academia controls every form of knowledge and is whitewashed, right? So even post all the independent states in the African continent, the presence of white control is really highly documented, right? And in America, they just celebrated the 400 years of slavery since the last slave ship was sent to America. And last year, there's this massive migration of black people, majorly from America and from all over the world, called the Year of Return. And everyone is entering back into the continent the best way they can, but it still goes back to who produces the knowledge. If you go down to Ghana and you look into the curriculum, you see that it's highly Western influenced, right? So how many knowledge producers do we have? We need to keep increasing our knowledge base. And just because of that, I'm like, okay, decolonization is an ongoing thing. But as an African or as a black person, that's just one aspect, right? Because that doesn't completely tell the story, right? So for me, this is me now. This is not me speaking for talk. For me, I go with the imagination, the power of imagination, uncolonized, pre-missionaries, pre-invaders, pre the white interaction. Who were we? You know, how you dig in deep into your history. A lot of the black diaspora who might not have a connection to their African identity, how do we reconnect them to that, right? And I'm coming back in June to take a workshop on this, and I'm bringing the idea of imagination, like the idea of imagining a foremother or a forefather from any part of the continent and begin to own that, because white oppression or white supremacy is an illusion. It's physically present, but it's an illusion that any white person who feels that they are superior, it's a lie. But systematically, they've told themselves that lie over and over again, and there are white people who believe it. That's why they're racist, that's why they're oppressed. And we as black people, we must realize that the slavery, this transatlantic slave trade, the colonization, all of this is just a fraction of who we are, right? Yeah.
On your website, you have the quote, "I'm not African because I was born in Africa, but because Africa was born in me." Can you like tell the importance behind that sentence or explain it?
Yes. So when I was about to write my mission statement, my research statement, my practice statement, I started doing some text references because there's so many white references to the idea of where do we come from and all of that. And a lot of the references I had is very oral, like it's embedded in our like historical storytelling, right? But I can't reference my grandmother or whatever, so which I can, but if I reference it, it'd be like, that's not knowledge, right? So then I started stumbling on the idea of reclaiming. So Chima Achebe, for instance, all this work is reimagining, reclaiming the identity. And when you listen to Kwame Nkrumah, he was speaking about Africa as an idea that connects people, that empowers identity, right? And that's a powerful statement from him. So for me now, a lot of the times when I speak to some black people in the diaspora, they'd be like, oh, I've not visited the country, I've not visited the continent, and you know, I want to feel African. And that's a statement that says, you are not African because you were born in Africa. Africa was born in you. So just like she said, German is my language. Wherever you step your foot on, however long you've been, you can claim whatever space you exist in. And to be African doesn't mean, not everybody has the flight ticket to go to Namibia or go to South Africa. You cannot remove the African identity away from them. It's not something that you can collect away from. They can have physical references, they can read books, they can have experiences by travels, but if a white person travels 50 years and go into the continent, does that make them African? No, it just make them knowledgeable. So it's a complete different case to be knowledgeable and to be. Every black person has an African identity and an African root if they choose to, because there are people who do not choose to. They choose to be present wherever they find themselves. And whoever chooses to reconnect, you can reclaim your identity. It's not to be bought, it's not to be given, it's not to be collected, it's within you. So you are not African or black because you were born. It's in you. You were born with it. Yeah.
Is it also a relatable sentence for you, Nadia?
Oh, I mean, if we want to speak about identity, whatever that might mean, we're going to sit here tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I find that really interesting because, I mean, I love what he's saying, and he's also saying it from a very particular experience and positioning. So what I'm about to say is should be considered the same. So I do agree. It's there is an element of choice. For example, I've lived in the United States in the black community very consciously for 7-8 years in New York because I needed a break from Germany, and then you know ultimately I came back to claim my Germanness and my Europeanness. But if you nail me down, I still could not tell you what Germanness or Europeanness actually means. I really do not. It's like, we call it Worthülsen, you know, whatever I could produce, it's like, you know, empty shells of words. So, and with the same, you know, and obviously I do claim my Africanness, but I can be really many things at the same time. And sister, it's not a problem whatsoever. I'm not divided. I'm not torn. I'm perfectly fine. I'm even richer. I'm juggling, I'm playing with that because I don't like to nail down identity. When I'm working and speaking and producing work in Germany, it's a political stand I'm taking. So I'm owning the blackness or the Africanness, but ultimately we were forced into that blackness, you know, by racism, you know, by the structures. So now I'm claiming it. You know, I'm taking it and I'm using it. But I know, actually, it's also in a way, ultimately, it will be an empty shell, maybe one day, and completely unnecessary. But now I'm carrying that shroud with pride. And it gives me, what is her name? The Indian, the philosopher of Indian descent, she called it a strategic essentialism. What is her name? Spivak used that term. It's an strategic essentialism. So blackness, yeah. So it has many, it's like when I flip it, it's a coin with many sides, you know, the way I want to speak about it. But yeah, sure. So I claim my Africanness, but I also insist on my Germanness, you know. And there are many things I own, and it's really funny because, for example, I love fashion. You know, I have a beautiful dress that was tailored by two Cameroonian sisters based in Munich, and they do they tailor a traditional Bavarian dresses called dirndl. You know, the dirndls with a little blouse and the little thing, and so dirndls and a little apron, but they fashion them from high quality African cloth, African prints. And so I love my dirndl, you know, it looks fantastic. It has some cowrie shells on it as well. And it makes traditionalists in Bavaria absolutely crazy and nuts. So when I have like an appointment in Munich to speak with somebody from the Christian Socialist Party, I make sure I always wear my dirndl, you know, just to trigger them. Because I own Bavarianness even. You know, I can be Bavarian, I am, you know, and so, yeah, it's a game.
Yeah, but this is actually what I'm saying, mm-hmm. because she asked me specifically from the African identity, because it means that as a person, you can claim mm-hmm. what you want to claim. It that statement completely opens how to reclaim your identity, because for me, I'm from Benin. Right, but I'm Asian, but then I'm from Edo State, then I moved to Lagos, and I have a bit of being a Lagosian, then I moved to Ghana, and I've been in Ghana for 6 years. You can't tell me that's not rubbing off me, and I keep up traveling. There's so many things, and sometimes when people see me be like, oh, you're not Nigerian enough, what does that mean? Right, so that's what this is. That statement gives you the power to add and remove and accept and denounce and claim. It just opens it up. Mm-hmm. So you can be anything. Just like I was talking about the Africans or black people in Japan or in Asia, for instance, who are completely from that culture, right? They don't know any other thing. You can't tell them they're not that. But then I'm saying, you can't tell them they're not black. You can't tell them they're not African. You can't tell them they're not what they say mm-hmm. they are. Right? So claim where you belong.
Yeah. But ultimately, maybe later or at some other moment, we have time to speak about the year of return.
Yes.
And the influx of African Americans
yes.
with a lot of money
yes.
who arrive now in Ghana, who yes. push into Ghana. And I was a bit concerned when I started picking up news
yes.
Because there's a discourse also on African American culture.
Very emotional one.
Very emotional, but there's also like this idea of, oh, we are all descendants of kings and queens,
that's,
you know, and this Afrocentric
that's
idea.
A false
I'm
reality.
Like, oh, no, you're not.
That's a
you
false
know?
Reality.
And what's wrong with being the descendant of peasants and
yes.
Goldsmiths and gardeners?
Yeah,
exactly. So I would like to talk to you about that because I'm wondering, is that sort of like also a very elite kind of culture tourism, and how will that affect Ghana, for example?
For example, there's an artist called Akon,
yeah,
right, and he made this popular statement like every Black American should return to Africa.
Okay,
you know, and we are all, like you said, from kings and queens. And I'm like, that's false. Like, you can count how many kings and queens have existed since maybe the first invasion, right? And also, this is from my observation, every monarchy in the continent that existed during the invasion, that existed during colonization and post, had to work with the invaders, the intruders, the abusers, the oppressors. So they kind of also represent a bit of that, right? So if you want to, if that is the only identity you want to claim, then that's the first reality. And historically, when you begin to look into our historical record, a lot of people have done work to go into giving voice to the voiceless, the peasant, the average, the normal, everyday person. But a lot of that voice is muted, right? And that's why it comes bringing it back to the conversations. Like, you could see a conversation with a driver, a tailor, a minister. It's everybody has the freedom to speak and say, this is who I am, right? And I actually wrote an essay on the year of return, and I'm going to be publishing it maybe in a few days. And it's rounding up, it's there's so many opinions about this happening, and I think every opinion is valid. And the case I'm making is, well, it's happening, so what can we do about it? And also, if a Black person decides to re-enter the continent through a party, through a conference, whatever they decide to re-enter the continent with, that's their decision. But now, how do we keep working the system to make sure that it's balanced, at least to a good point? Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was awesome. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you all so much. It was so, just beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for having us.
Das Gespräch mit Nadia Ofoate-Alazar vom Berliner Verein EOTO und Ohiobe Omoblanks Omohimi, der derzeit Artist in Residency ist beim Verein Embassy in Hamburg. Dort setzt er gerade seine Forschungs- und Archivierungsarbeiten fort, trifft sich mit Menschen der Black Community in Hamburg und er hat eine Art Videoinstallation entwickelt, die ins Ghana der kolonialen Befreiung führt in die 50er Jahre. Die könnt ihr euch noch anschauen, wenn ihr in Hamburg seid, am 15. Februar in der Embassy. Es gibt in vielen deutschen Städten in diesem Monat Veranstaltungen zum Black History Month. Ein paar davon habe ich euch in die Shownotes zu diesem Podcast geschrieben, genauso wie einige weitere Tipps und Klicks zum Thema. Hier geht es jetzt weiter mit Klaus Walter und einer neuen Ausgabe seiner Kolumne.
Fangen wir an mit einer
Berichtigung.
Shit happens im engeren Sinn des Wortes shit. In der letzten Ausgabe der Gegenwartsfunde habe ich Scheiße erzählt, und zwar diese hier. Billie Eilish über Pooping. What's so funny about Pooping? Witze übers Furzen kenne ich eigentlich aus meiner Jugend im Fußballverein.
Pooping is my favorite part of the day. There was one day I pooped 8 times. That was the best day of my life. And they were all solid, good poops too. Like no like bullshit poops, you know what I'm saying? I wasn't like, I'm done. Those are the bad poops. When you poop, I'm really talking about poop out here. I love pooping, dude.
Tja, Billie Eilish über die Freuden des Pooping. Von Solid Good Poops hat Billie Eilish berichtet und ich habe an das komische Wort Pupsen gedacht. Pupsen ist ja so eine Art verklemmte Variante für Furzen. Und zum Glück hören Leute aufmerksam zu bei dieser Audiokolumne. Diese Leute haben mich dann belehrt, dass Pooping nicht etwa Furzen heißt, sondern Scheißen. Der beste Tag im Leben von Billie Eilish war also der Tag, an dem sie 8-mal scheißen konnte. Und zwar nur solid good poops, nicht etwa Kleinkram. Was sagt uns jetzt diese Information über die Kunst von Billie Eilish? Darüber muss ich nochmal nachdenken. Jedenfalls bitte ich um Entschuldigung für diesen Übersetzungsfehler. Im Grunde könnte ich diese ganze Kolumne mit Billie Eilish füllen. Es vergeht ja kein Tag ohne Billie Eilish News. Die Vogue zum Beispiel hat ihr gerade eine gigantische Coverstory gewidmet. Da spricht Billie Eilish ausgiebig auch über ihre Ängste und über ihre Depressionen, zum Beispiel über einen Britney-Moment. Ich zitiere mal, der Britney-Moment. Man wächst auf und denkt sich, die sind hübsch, die sind dünn. Warum richten die sich so zugrunde? Aber je älter ich werde, desto mehr bemerke ich, oh mein Gott, natürlich blieb denen nichts anderes übrig. In meinen düsteren Momenten mache ich mir Sorgen, dass ich genau zu dem Klischee werde, zu dem jeder junge Künstler zu werden droht, wie ja alle meinen. Und warum schließlich auch nicht? Letztes Jahr, als ich auf meiner Tour durch Europa an meinem persönlichen Tiefpunkt angelangt war, hatte ich Angst davor, dass ich zusammenbreche und mir den Kopf rasiere. Das also war der Britney-Moment von Billie Eilish. Und in dieser Vogue-Geschichte gibt es noch einen Link zu Billie Eilish's Best Fashion Moments auf Instagram. Auch da kann man viel Zeit verbringen. Und es gibt die Rubrik 5 Things You Didn't Know About Billie Eilish. Und in dieser Rubrik habe ich gelernt, dass Billie Eilish Invisalign benutzt. Was bitte? Invisalign, ich hatte keine Ahnung, was das ist, also habe ich die Suchmaschine angeworfen und habe gelernt, was das ist. Invisalign ist die weltweit meistbenutzte transparente Zahnspange. 6 Millionen Lächeln weltweit für Erwachsene und Kinder geeignet. I love my smile gibt es nur bei echten Kieferorthopäden. Vorher-Nachher-Simulation, schnell und günstig, zinsfreie Ratenzahlung. Tja, vielleicht kannte ich Invisalign nicht, weil ich aus dem Zahnspangenalter raus bin. Wobei Zahnspange, glaube ich, gar nicht mehr mit Alter zu tun hat heutzutage. So oder so, jetzt habe ich auch endlich verstanden, was es mit dem ersten Track von Billie Eilish's Album auf sich hat. Der ist 14 Sekunden kurz und der Titel besteht nur aus 7 Ausrufezeichen. Und der Track geht so.
My Invisalign has...
I have taken out my Invisalign.
I have taken out my Invisalign and this is the album.
7 Ausrufezeichen von Billie Eilish, der Opener ihres Albums mit dem immer noch sehr schönen Titel When We Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? Und was haben wir da gehört? 40 seconds of a sound familiar to any user of the dental aids, the click of taking them out. Also das Klicken, wenn man die Zahnspange rausnimmt. Invisalign. Man lernt nie aus. Und ich habe auch noch ein schönes Wort kennengelernt. Ein schönes Wort für eine nicht so schöne Sache. Orthodontia. Klingt toll, oder? Orthodontia. Eilish's Orthodontia makes frequent appearances in her interviews. Orthodontia heißt einfach Kieferorthopädie. Klingt aber irgendwie besser, Orthodontia. Okay, jetzt wissen wir nicht nur Bescheid über die Verdauung von Billie Eilish, sondern auch darüber, wie es zwischen den Zähnen von Billie Eilish aussieht. Irgendwie fällt mir dauernd das Wort vom Terror der Intimität ein und ich komme ein bisschen komisch vor dabei. Habe ich vielleicht einen Billie Eilish-Fetisch? Ist das normal in meinem Alter? Andere Leute sterben mit 64, Andy Gill von der Gang of Four zum Beispiel. Andy Gill ist gestorben an einer Atemwegserkrankung. Er wurde nur 64. Und ich zitiere mal mich selbst aus meinem Nachruf für die Taz. Zum Trademark-Sound der Band Gang of Four steuert Andy Gill ein Gitarrenspiel bei. Das klingt wie nix in der Geschichte des Rock, weil es nicht eingehen will in die Geschichte des Rock. Die antirockistische, vom afroamerikanischen Funk und vom jamaikanischen Dub informierte Klangästhetik der Gang of Four hat Gefühl und Bewusstsein für Leerstellen, für Hohlräume. Der Kritiker Paul Morley spricht von awkward holes and sharp corners. Um die scharfen Ecken in die unbehaglichen Löcher stößt Gills Gitarre wie ein Steakmesser in die Haut. Statt Gitarrensoli gab es bei uns Antisoli. Man hörte einfach auf zu spielen, da blieb nur ein Loch, sagt Andy Gill. Aber zurück zu Billie Eilish, es gibt kein Entrinnen. 5 Grammys hat Billie Eilish gewonnen für ihr Album mit dem nach wie vor schönen Titel When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? Und unter diesen 5 Grammys die sogenannten Big Four, Album, Record, Song und Best New Artist. Damit ist Billie Eilish die erste Frau, der das gelungen ist und das mit 18 Jahren. Und selbstverständlich ist die erste Frau, der das gelungen ist, eine weiße Frau. Wie die Oscars sind auch die Grammys nach wie vor rassifiziert. Lizzo, die afroamerikanische Sängerin, hat 3 Grammys gewonnen. Da lohnt sich ein Blick auf die Kategorien. Best Pop Solo Performance, Best Urban Contemporary Album und Best Traditional R&B Performance. Und Urban und R&B sind nach wie vor schamhafte Umschreibungen für Musik von schwarzen Leuten. Lizzo gewinnt also 3 Grammys, aber keinen in der Königinnen-Disziplin. I'm a thick bitch, I need tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Slow songs in the skinny house. Fuck it up to the tempo. Zurück zu Billie Eilish, ihr werdet sie nicht los in dieser Runde Gegenwartsfunde. Kurz vor den Grammys wurde bekannt, dass Billie Eilish eine besondere Ehre zuteil wird. Sie wird den Titelsong des neuen James-Bond-Films komponieren und interpretieren, zusammen mit ihrem Bruder natürlich komponieren und produzieren. No Time to Die soll der Film heißen und hier ist schon mal ein kleiner Vorgeschmack aus dem Song. Super spy movie. It's called No Time to Die. Get drunk, have sex, and shoot a gun. Being James Bond sounds fun.
He's a Bond guy. Duh.
So klingt der künftige James Bond Song in der Late Night Show von Stephen Colbert. Super Text auch, ich zitiere mal. Sich betrinken, Sex haben, mit der Knarre herumballern. James Bond zu sein, das klingt nach Spaß. Und damit viel Spaß mit einem meiner Lieblings-James-Bond-Songs. Die Specials vor bald 40 Jahren. Suck it to MJB.
Are you ready for this? I told you it was coming.
Who?
JB. And he's ready to suck it to you one time.
Musikkritik zum Ausklang dieser Podcast-Ausgabe. Und genau da setzen wir auch an in der nächsten Folge. Wir besprechen das neue Album von Grimes, das erscheint am 21. Februar, und setzen uns dafür in einer kleinen Kritikerinnenrunde der Spex-Redaktion zusammen.
Ihr hört uns dann in 2 Wochen, diesmal am Freitag, nicht am Donnerstag schon. Und dann gibt es auch eine neue Ausgabe von WorldCont mit Mitu Sanyal. Ihr könnt also gespannt bleiben, uns vielleicht bis dahin noch einen Kommentar hinterlassen, eine Bewertung oder eine Mail schreiben an podcast@spex.de. Bleibt spexy, bis zum nächsten Mal.